Well, good morning, everybody. I would say it's good to see all of you, except I can't see most of you. Oh, there you are. As Mr. Thomas mentioned, third day of the feast already. And it seems to, at least from my perspective, things seem to be going well. I have to share something with you. When the speaking schedule came out, and I had someone ask me about this, I noticed next to my name a little Y. And that made me feel pretty good. I assumed that was Mr. Blackwell's way of telling me how young I look. Of course, good looking would go with that, but I'm too humble to point that out. Then I found out, it actually stood for youth sermon. Well, I was excited about that. I was happy for that, but it was a little let down that it wasn't my young looks beside that. So the sermon is intended to be for, I think, three categories of people, those of us that are here. Those who are young, the children, the teens, the young adults, those who are young at heart, and that's obviously a much broader category. And the third category is those who used to be young. And I figure between those, probably most of us are covered. Well, let me ask this. How many of you here are from Texas? You've come up from Texas. Yeah, I see hands coming up all over. Good. You will relate to this story I'm about to tell you. Before I share the story with you, I want to say that, you know, many people have been facing trials and challenges. We know some nationwide, worldwide challenges the world has been facing. But I also know many of you have been facing specific challenges, obstacles that have been thrown in your path. Many of them, they may challenge your health. They may challenge your job. Some of them probably challenge your faith as well. Some of them are severe trials, and they make you feel like, I don't know if I can get through this. You almost feel like you've got to be able to walk on water to be able to make it through these kind of trials and challenges. Well, I've got a story to tell you about a young man who did walk on water. You see, there was a wealthy rancher down in Texas. That's why I ask how many of you are from Texas. And he was concerned about some of the young single men in his area, so he invited a bunch of bachelors out to his ranch for a good old Texas-style barbecue. He had all the men together there. He had the smoker, the cooker. He had a table lined out with food, and he gathered the men at the edge of a pristine-looking little lake. And he said, "Fellas, look out over the edge of this here little lake. It is plumb full of alligators and crocodiles. If anyone is willing to go across right now, make it through all them gators and crocs, clear from this side to the other, I'll give you one of three things. I'll give you a 500-acre ranch of your own. I'll give you $1 million in cash. Or I'll give you the hand of one of my beautiful daughters in marriage." No sooner had he uttered those words than there was a terrific splash. And in shock, he looked down and there was a young man out in the water. He hadn't even bothered to take his shoes off. And this young man, he was going for all he was worth. Water was flying everywhere. He was dancing off the noses of alligators and crocodiles, and all of them were hissing and snapping at him. But unbelievably, the young man made it to the other side. He was soaked to the bone, but without a scratch. When the rancher got around to the other side, he said to him, "Son, I really didn't think anyone would be crazy enough to do that, but I'm a man of my word. So which do you want? Do you want the ranch? Do you want the money? Or do you want to marry one of my daughters?" After the frazzled young man was finally able to catch his breath, he looked back at the rancher and he says, "I really don't want any of them, sir. I just want to get my hands on the fellow what pushed me into the lake." Kind of a predictable story, I know. My kids have been teasing me a lot the last several years about dad jokes. But I've come to a conclusion. You see, every time they accuse me of telling a dad joke, I realize dad jokes are the really good, really funny ones. So I'm taking it as a compliment now. That's what it is. It's a silly little joke, I know. But isn't that how life feels sometimes? Doesn't it feel like you are having to dance on the heads of alligators and crocodiles while every one of them are trying to rip a chunk out of you? You feel like you're going to have to walk on water to survive. What do you do at times like that? What can you do? Challenges to various aspects of your life, but especially those that challenge your faith. What do you do? Let's go to Acts chapter 14. Paul was a guy who knew something about going through trials and difficulties. Acts chapter 14. We'll begin in verse 19. It says, "Then Jews from Antioch and Iconium came there, having persuaded the multitudes, they stoned Paul." Now, when the Bible talks about stoning, this isn't just, pebbles, this isn't just even fist-sized rocks. Stoning would typically be done with a rock as big as a man could pick up over his head and throw. They stoned Paul and dragged him out of the city, supposing him to be dead. However, when the disciples gathered around him, he rose up and went into the city, and the next day departed with Barnabas to Derbe. Paul had faced all kinds of problems. He has been shipwrecked. He's faced any number of potentially fatal conflicts. This time he was stoned and left for dead, certainly unconscious. Was he actually dead? If he was, God certainly raised him up. He was close to death. He was close enough that they thought he was done for. And verse 21, when they had preached, after they went to Derbe, when they had preached the gospel to that city and made many disciples, they returned to Lystra, Iconium, and Antioch, strengthening the souls of the disciples and exhorting them to continue in the faith and saying, "We must through many tribulations enter the kingdom of God." So here's Paul coming back through the area, no doubt looking a little worse for the wear, and reminding the brethren, we're going to go through trials. We must through many tribulations enter the kingdom of God. It isn't going to be easy, folks. There are going to be times when you feel like you're dancing on the heads of gators and crocs and just doing everything you can to stay alive. But everyone's going to go through them. We all do. We've gone through many. There are many more to go. And we have to do that to enter the kingdom of God. How do we do that? What do we do? I want to look at a true story this time, unlike the Texas rancher. I don't think that one was real. But I want to look at a true story of a man who was a young adult at this point, and he literally did walk on water. And I think there are some important lessons for us to learn. I might ask at this point, have any of you ever walked on water? I have. I've actually walked on water more times than I can count. I've ridden a bicycle on the top of water. I've driven a tractor on water. I've even taken a 5-gallon bucket out on water and sat down and fished. Of course, it was up north where I grew up, and the water was frozen at least a foot thick, sometimes two or more. I've never walked on liquid water. Let's go to Matthew chapter 14. By way of a little bit of background, what we're about to read comes at the end of a very stressful and a very difficult time. John the Baptist was Jesus Christ's cousin. I think most of you know that. He was about 6 months or so older than Jesus Christ. And he had been arrested. He was being held in prison until Herod, because of a rather sordid family situation, allowed his stepdaughter to demand the head of John the Baptist on a platter. So John was executed. He was dishonored. And when the news got out, and news like that spreads fast, I'm sure Jesus Christ and the disciples, it hit them hard. Christ is the Messiah, the Son of God. He knows the power that God has. But still, something like this is going to have a heavy impact. And so Jesus had gone to find a quiet place. And I think we understand that. There are times you just need that. You need to get away for a little bit. You need to find a quiet place to regroup. And that's what he did. But the crowds followed him. And before the day was done, he had performed a miracle to feed 5,000 men, it says, plus women and children. It doesn't say how many women and children, but if you read some of the commentaries, there are estimates that there may have been as many as 10,000 people total out there. That's a lot of folks. My very first Feast of Tabernacles, I don't go back as far as some of these guys who were speaking earlier in the feast, probably due to my youth. Just keep plugging that once in a while. But my very first feast was in the Lake of the Ozarks, up the road here a ways. And there were approximately 12,000 people. How many of you ever kept the feast up in Lake of the Ozarks? You remember that giant parking lot? Had to be a mile long with one way in and out. You remember that? How could you miss it? 12,000 people there in that giant metal building. The crowd on the shore was just slightly less than what we had in Lake of the Ozarks for the feast. That's a huge crowd. That's a lot of folks. So he has fed them. And in verse 22, it was time to send the crowds away, let them go back home. Verse 22 of Matthew 14. And immediately Jesus made his disciples get into a boat and go before him to the other side while he sent the multitudes away. The Greek word here is pretty strong. When it says made, my margin says invited or strongly urged. That doesn't quite cover it. The Greek word here means to compel, to order, to command. It was not a, hey fellas, why don't you go ahead and get in the boat, head on over to the other side, I'll join you over there. Maybe they were worried. I mean, Herod has had John the Baptist arrested and beheaded. Maybe they're concerned. Herod could have soldiers waiting for us on the other side. Maybe they were reluctant to leave their friend and master. Over here, he's grieving the loss of his cousin. He's got 10,000 people to send away. But he was insistent. He said, guys, get in the boat. Get in there and go. I'll get over there. I won't have a problem with that. So they did. Verse 23, and when he had sent the multitudes away, he went up to the mountain by himself to pray. He still needed that time to commune with the Father and probably settle his own. He was human. He was God in the flesh, but he was human. He had emotions to deal with and maybe settle his mind and settle his emotions. He went up on the mountain by himself to pray. Now, when evening had come, he was alone there. But the boat was in the middle of the sea, tossed by waves, for the wind was contrary. Now, remember, many of the disciples, they were fishermen. They were very familiar with the Sea of Galilee, which... It's a bit misnamed. The Sea of Galilee isn't really a sea. It's more like a big inland lake. But they were used to it. They knew boats. They knew how to handle boats. The boats in this area were built for operating on this little tiny sea. Like I said, it's not really a sea. To put it in comparison, if you compare The Sea of Galilee with Lake Erie. That's the smallest of the U.S. Great Lakes. Lake Erie is approximately 100 times larger than the Sea of Galilee. Sea of Galilee is only 13 miles long from north to south. At its widest, it's about 8 miles wide. Maximum depth at the deepest point is between 150 and 200 feet. All right, that's pretty deep, deeper than I want to go down. But the way it's situated, the topography allows for violent storms to come up very quickly. The lake itself, the surface of the lake, sits about 700 feet below sea level. But it's completely ringed in mountains, and the mountains rise up around 2,000 feet. And as I read about this, they said when the cool air from the mountains comes down and it hits the warm, moist air coming up from the Sea of Galilee, very violent and dangerous storms can pop up almost instantly. Very quickly, these violent storms can come up. And that's what happened. So think about it. Here they are at the end of a very long and draining day. They've learned about the death of John the Baptist. There have been 10,000 people to feed and to take care of, and Jesus was teaching them, and they're shuttling a lot of baskets. How many trips back and forth did they have to make to feed that many people? It's been a long day. And now this storm suddenly comes out of nowhere and slams them, and they're out there on the lake. Let me ask you something. Do you ever find that trials hit you when you are least prepared for them? You ever notice that? Why is it on days when you feel like you cannot handle one more thing? That's when you get that phone call. That's when something happens, and that one more thing, maybe a really heavy thing, hits. It had to be how the disciples felt. That this is not the day for another challenge. This is not the day for another trial. But it was. And we know God is able to calm the storms. The disciples knew that. He can calm the physical storms. God is able to resolve our trials and our problems. And we pray for it. We ask Him to do so. And we know God can just say, boom. And whatever it is, it's done. It's resolved. It goes away. And that's what we want. But more often than not, what God chooses to do is help us go through the storm. One author phrased it like this. He said, rather than calming the storms, God often works to calm us to go through the storm. I thought that was a pretty neat way of phrasing it, because that's what happens. So here they are out on the lake. This storm springs up. And in verse 24, we know that, well, God allows these trials and these storms because they have a way of correcting us. They help us see our weaknesses. There are times when we need something to be built, or we need something to be pointed out to us that we have to correct. We have to overcome and grow. God knows what we need, and He knew what the disciples need. In verse 24, in the Arabic text, it says they were, in my New King James, it says, in the middle of the sea. Arabic text indicates that they were about 25 furlongs from shore. So you all know what that means. You know how many furlongs you have on your car? No? 25 furlongs translates into about 4 miles. Now realize, the Sea of Galilee is at its widest about 8 miles across. That would put them most likely in the exact middle of the Sea of Galilee. At night, in a heavy storm, heavy winds, lashing rain, and they're tired. They're worn out, and here they are. You know, one of the lessons I think the disciples needed to learn was a lesson about faith. Think about this. when Jesus was physically with them, they did pretty well. I mean, what do you have to fear? He could heal people. He could provide wine out of nothing but barrels of water. He could feed thousands. He could even raise people up from the dead. He could do anything. So when they were with him, what did they have to fear? What was the worry? We just were with him, and we leave it to him to sort things out, tell us where to go, and take care of problems. But this time he wasn't with them. He was somewhere back on the other side. They were all alone, in the dark, battling the wind and the driving rain, as they probably tried to tack back and forth and row toward the shore. We just have to get off the water. No sleep for anybody that night. The end of a long day, and it was a struggle. They were, in essence, rowing against, well, not against the tide, but they were rowing against the storm. We're told the wind was contrary. It was blowing them straight in the face, away from where they wanted to go. How tired do you suppose they got that night? I've been on a number of canoe trips. I've been on a memorable one or two with Mr. Blackwell, but that's a story for another time. Let's just say somewhere in Missouri, there is a package of expensive, fat-free hot dogs still bouncing along the bottom of one of those rivers. I've been on some Boundary Waters trips up in northern Minnesota, up on the Canadian border. And you know, you get out on a big lake, on big water, when the wind is blowing against you, and it's a struggle. We're paddling along, and you look over at the shore, and it's hard to determine, are we actually going forward or are we going backward? And you're paddling hard, and your arms, they start to ache. And the muscles in your back, they start to ache and sometimes even cramp up. But you know, if you stop rowing, even for a moment, you're going to lose progress. And it's going to be twice as hard to gain that progress again. And that's probably how the disciples felt. We've got to keep going. If we don't, he told us he's going to meet us on the other side. I don't know what he's doing. Airplanes haven't been invented yet, so I know he's not taking one of those. But if we stop, we're going to be blown up onto the shore, maybe onto the rocks on the other side. That's the way life is. And trials that hit us. God's called all of us to row against the wind, against the tidal currents of this world. We have to resist, don't we? We have to resist all the pulls that are telling us, you're tired. Surely you can just relax for a little bit. But there's constant pressure from the world, from society, from friends, from classmates, maybe relatives, maybe cousins who really don't care. They're not worried about living up to the standards of God like you are. And there's that constant push and pressure. Why do I have to keep resisting? Can't I let down for just a little bit? Can't I relax for just a little bit? Just this evening? Or just this party? Or just with this girl or this guy? Can't I just relax a little bit? Why do I have to keep pushing? Well, we know what happens if you let down. You'll lose a lot of ground, won't you? Morally, in terms of character, you lose a lot of ground, then it's going to be twice as hard to make it up again. And in some cases, you can never make it the way it was before. And so, we have to keep going. And they were too. Verse 25, it says, in the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went to them walking on the sea. And when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were troubled, saying, it's a ghost, and they cried out in fear. Yeah, I can see that. Not something you see every day. Here comes some fellow walking out across the sea. By the typical divisions of the night watches, the fourth watch would have begun around 3 a.m. So that tells you how long they've been working at this thing. They've been at this a while. Very dark, no sleep, early in the morning, battling a storm, trying to get across, when something you never could have imagined happened. Some guy is walking on the water. But this man isn't walking on frozen water. I told you I've walked on water lots of times, even driven a tractor out on water. But it was frozen good and solid and thick. This is liquid water in the middle of a storm. He's not walking over alligators and crocodiles either. But, you know, this is the one who created water. How hard can it be for him to walk on it, even in the midst of a gale? And that's when something unusual happened. Verse 27, immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, "Be of good cheer, it is I, do not be afraid." They calmed back down. I wonder how many of them were thinking, he's on this side, man, I'm going over, off the other side, I don't care if there's a storm. But he calmed them down, said, "It's me." And Peter did something. I would guess this has to have been one of the most exciting few minutes in Peter's life as he thought back on them. And Peter answered him and said, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water." So he said, "Come." All right. Peter, it's interesting the wording. Peter was the only one with maybe the enthusiasm, the unbridled curiosity, the lack of inhibition, whatever it was about Peter. Peter was the only one who said, "Call me out there. Bid me to come to you." When Jesus said, "Come," in verse 29, it's a little more than just an invitation. It's a little more than, sure, you want to come out? Come on out. There's an element of a command in there. Come. Peter, you, get over the boat, right? You know, as parents, we hopefully teach our children, all of our kids, you need them for something and you call. Call them by name. Daniel, come here. Now, we do it politely until they don't respond, and then we do it more sternly, and then we threaten them. Well, maybe not. Maybe so. But, you know, as parents, when you tell your child, come, there's a command. I'm your parent. I need you here. I want you here. There's some reason I need you over here. And Jesus Christ, he says, come. I have to wonder, what were the other disciples thinking at that point? They saw all of this. Were they thinking, Peter, you're nuts. What are you doing? Did any of them encourage him? Yeah, go for it, Peter. Did they tell him they thought he was nuts? Or did they just sit there in stunned silence to watch and see what happens next and somebody get a life jacket ready to fish him out? I don't know, but they saw all of this. You know, you and I, we'll all face challenges. We'll face tough decisions, especially when it comes to obeying God. How do we deal with that when we face criticism? When we have people telling us, what? You are going to jeopardize your job? This is a good job. Do you know how hard it is to get a job like this? And you're going to jeopardize your job over keeping the Sabbath? Or leaving for the feast in the middle of the fall when nobody goes to Branson that time of year. You're going to jeopardize your job over that? How do we handle it when our faith is challenged and we're facing criticism? Or maybe just lack of encouragement. You want to do that? Okay. And people watch. How do we handle that? Do we go anyway? I've also thought about Peter. Have you ever wondered what was going through his mind at this point? I know if it was me, and I blurted something like that, hey, call me over. And Jesus says, come. And the next thing that's going to go through my mind is, what have I done? Why did I say that? I have got to learn to keep my mouth shut. All right, but he called me. I've got to go. How do you think he got out of the boat? Now, these boats, typically they've got a little bit higher sides. They would have been wooden boats probably. Well, definitely. Did he, you know, you see these guys when they bring a boat into the shore and they'll kill the motor just as it's coming up to the sand, and there's one guy on the bow, and right when that keel hits the sand, he leaps off with a rope in his hand, lands on the shore to secure that boat. Is that how Peter left the boat? Get up on the side, just take a big jump? I don't know, but if it were me, that's not how I would have done it. Did Peter hang on to the side of the boat, slip his legs over, and kind of lower himself down until his feet touch the water? And I tell you what, if my feet go underwater and I get wet, I'm coming right back up. But lower himself down, and I'm not sinking. Then Peter is thinking, this is cool. Wait till I tell Mom about this. Right? And he actually is walking on water, and he's walking out toward Jesus Christ. It is an awesome thing. And I suspect if you think about it, you'll understand this. It is an awesome thing to realize that God is opening doors for you, that God is maybe giving you the right words to say, to solve a problem, and it's working out right before your eyes. How many times has God done that for you? I wonder how many times has He done things like that for me and I didn't even recognize it. It's probably that way for you too, but when you stop and think about it, and maybe you think about it afterwards and you realize, wow, this is what God did. How incredible is that? You know, there have been many times that I have recognized that in my life. There have been times when members have told me how this is what I was facing, and I was bracing for the worst, and you see it work out right before your eyes. God's resolving things. You see God's hand. It's an incredible thing. And that's probably how Peter felt as well. Hold your finger here. We're going to come right back, but I want you to look at 2 Corinthians chapter 5. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 4, we'll kind of break into the middle of Paul's thought. 2 Corinthians 5, verse 4, Paul writes, "For we who are in this tent," in other words, in the flesh, groan, being burdened, not because we want to be unclothed, not because we're looking forward to dying, but to be further clothed, that mortality may be swallowed up by life. We're looking for the life to come, the world to come. "Now he who prepared us with this very thing is God, who has also given us the Spirit as a guarantee. So we are always confident, knowing that while we are at home in the body, we are absent from the Lord. For we walk by faith, not by sight." He said, we struggle with all kinds of things. And remember, Paul knew what struggle was all about. Paul knew what trials and difficulties were all about. And he said, we're burdened. We groan. At times, it is difficult. It's a challenge. We're not anxious for life to end, but we are anxious to get on to a better future, aren't we? It's the future this feast reminds us of. But in the process, Paul tells us we have to walk by faith. We must step out in faith. Think about Peter again for a moment. Unless the Sea of Galilee freezes over thick enough, and I didn't look that up, but my guess is in that part of the world, no, that doesn't happen. Peter never walked on water before. Peter had to put his feet down, and it held. I don't know how it held. I don't know how I'm standing up here, but I can walk. And Peter had to step out in faith. He had to let go of the boat, didn't he? He had to take a step and let go of the boat. You know, think about it. In those circumstances, would you be willing to get out of the boat? When challenges, when difficulties, when things are trials of your faith, they challenge your faith. Are you willing to get out of the boat and walk by faith, not by sight? There was nothing Peter could see that would give him any reason to believe he could walk on water except for Jesus Christ. You look down at the water, I don't know, could he see fish down there? At that point, I'm guessing he can't see the bottom. Of course, it's dark and stormy anyway. All he sees is, this is not possible. But he stepped out in faith. Go back to Matthew 14. Let's continue with the story. So Peter, he gets out on the water. He has to let go of the boat and start walking away from it. But, verse 30, when he saw that the wind was boisterous, he was afraid and began to sink and cried out, saying, Lord, save me. What did he do? His elation, this is cool. This is really, I'm walking on water. And then he looked around and said, I can't walk on water. What in the world am I doing? And he looked around, and what did he focus on? All he focused on was the problem. Don't we do the exact same thing when challenges hit? We see the problem and we see the obstacles and we see the impossibility of what we're facing. And we see how I can never get through this. There is no way I'm going to die. Life as I know it is over. All we see is the problem. And when Peter focused on the problem, what was he not focused on? He wasn't focused on his Savior. He wasn't focused on Jesus Christ. When you and I, when all we focus on is the problem, we don't see God. We don't see His hand. We're not focused on His strength. And all Peter could say is, I can't do this. There is no way. And he started to sink. And in a moment, he went from being on top of the world, well, on top of the lake anyway, to suddenly drowning. Peter realized by himself, I can't walk on water. And his problems were about to overwhelm him. You ever noticed how a little tiny baby, you put him down, maybe you put him down for a nap. Maybe he's so small you're still putting him in a bassinet. Have you ever seen a tiny baby wail forlornly when mommy or daddy puts him down in his bassinet or his crib and walks out of the room? Why do they do that? Well, how many of you remember being that small? All right. Me neither. But what I have read, the best that we can understand, since none of us remember that, is that for a baby, the concept of people walking out of a room and coming back, it doesn't register. When that baby can't see you, you don't exist anymore. When mommy or daddy walk out of the room, that baby, there's a fear, are they coming back? There's that relationship has to be built. Over time, he learns that, yes, they do come back. Now, he may still cry, but it's because he doesn't want to lay down and take a nap, not because he thinks mommy and daddy have ceased to exist because they went into another room. He learns to trust them. He may not like it, and as he gets older and they give him instructions, and he's going to be a child, and he's going to push the boundaries. But he learns to trust his parents. We have to do the same thing with God. We're battling problems, but the moment we lose sight of God, in our minds, if we're not careful, hey, we're adults, we're grown-ups, we understand this. But what happens? Emotionally, the moment we lose sight of God and all we see is our problems, it's almost as if God doesn't exist and it's just me. And I'm battling all these alligators and crocodiles and they're trying to tear me to shreds and I can't win. We get tunnel vision and we know we're in trouble deep. We lose sight of God. We feel like He isn't there. He doesn't care. He doesn't answer my problems. Maybe He's abandoned me. Once again, hold your finger. We'll come right back. I want you to look at Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews 12. Verse 1, the author of Hebrews, I think most likely this was the Apostle Paul also, but he writes in verse 1, "Therefore we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses," he's just gone through chapter 11, all these heroes of faith and all of the times where God intervened and He took care of them. In some cases they died, in some cases He delivered them. But God didn't leave any of them. And He said, I want you to see this. I want you to understand this. We are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses. Let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, that can attack our faith, that can challenge our character, that can destroy our character. Just one evening. Just let down a little bit. And so much can be destroyed. And let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. Verse 2, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before Him endured the cross or the stake, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Bible in Basic English says, verse 2, having our eyes fixed on Jesus, the guide and end of our faith. That word for fixed, that word for looking to, means to have our attention focused on like glue. You ever been in a situation where something is happening and you can't tear your eyes away? Right? It's so dramatic, it's so exciting, it's so whatever. That's what He's saying, that you can't tear your eyes away. You are focused on our older brother, on the Messiah, like glue. Because the moment we lose sight of Him and all we see is our problems, that's when we begin to sink. We always have to learn to keep our attention focused on God. Let's go back to Matthew 14. And I pulled my finger out after I told you to keep yours in there. Matthew 14. Verse 31, and immediately Jesus stretched out His hand and caught him. And He said, O you of little faith, why did you doubt? I was right here. Why did you begin to doubt? When Peter cried out in panic, Jesus simply reached out, took him by the hand, and brought him back up. You see, faith is understanding that God's ability to do great things, as long as we continue to obey and follow Him, is never diminished. God's ability to do great things is not dependent on the challenges we face. It's not dependent on the anger, bad intentions, bad attitudes of the people we may have to deal with. It's not dependent on the size of the problems. As long as we remain with our eyes glued to Him, as long as we remain focused on Him, there's nothing that can diminish what God can do. Verse 32, and when they got into the boat, the wind ceased. That's it. It's over. This lesson has come to a conclusion. Just like that. but it left them with a lot of things to mull over and consider the lessons that they had to learn. You know, it was many, many years ago, I lost my job over going to keep the feast. I had told my boss, this is what I needed to do. He didn't say anything at the time. I'd given plenty of notice, and we left for the feast. My wife and I had a baby, and soon discovered we had a second baby on the way. And I came home from the feast with the instructions that I had 30 minutes to clean out my desk, turn in my keys, and be off the property. Bummer. All right, go back out, find another job. Couldn't find one. Over the next 6 months, we lost our apartment. We lost our car. We moved in with my in-laws, slept on their living room sofa. Very grateful to have their sofa to sleep on. But I couldn't find work anywhere. I applied everywhere. I had a stack of rejection letters an inch high. I've been turned down for some pretty fancy jobs, I'll tell you that. I applied one place, a very large employer. And I don't know how it happened, but somehow my application got caught in a loop. And every opportunity that came up, they were submitting my application. Things I was not qualified for at all. But the really discouraging thing was, I'm sitting at home watching the mail, I'm on the phone, I'm going to as many interviews as I can, and suddenly I start getting rejection letters for jobs I hadn't even applied for. It's like, just in case you were thinking of it, don't bother. That's a little tough to swallow. But you know the interesting thing? When God decided that the lessons that I needed to learn, all the raw materials were there for me to finally put all this together, and that takes years. You look back on it and you learn more and more things. But when God finally decided this trial was over, just like the storm, it ended. After 6 months of not being able to beg, borrow, or steal a job, all of a sudden I got 4 job offers in 1 week. So where have you folks been for 6 months? Now all of a sudden I have to choose which one I'm going to accept. But when the trial was over, it ended. And that's exactly what happened here. Now it was time to pick up, begin to rebuild, you know, what we needed as a family and move forward. And that's exactly where Peter and the rest of the disciples were. This story and this incident, this experience, I wonder how many times over the next few years and decades did they look back on that and think, that was there too. There was a lesson in that too. We can count on him. We learn to trust him. There's a lesson in faith. There's a lesson in perseverance. So many things that they had to learn. You know, the Bible is clear that we all are going to face heavy trials and heavy burdens before Jesus Christ returns. Every one of us, we could sit down and begin to share our stories. And we know we've been through a lot, but there's more to come. As I suppose the old Bachman-Turner Overdrive song goes, you ain't seen nothing yet. There's still more to come. We may feel like we're drowning. We may feel like the only way to survive is to walk on water. We have to dance on the noses of alligators and crocodiles, every one of them trying to rip us to shreds. And the thing is, most of these trials, there is no way to avoid them. You can't get around it. Your boss calls you in and says, you have a choice to make, son. It's either keep the Sabbath or lose your job. You can't avoid that. You have to make a decision. Either you go into work and you violate the Sabbath, or you go keep the Sabbath and wonder if you're going to have to clean out your desk or your locker as soon as you show back up around the office. You can't avoid them. Maybe we feel like we're in the middle of a dangerous storm and we struggle, we pull against the wind and the storm and we endure for weeks or months or years and we get tired, but we can't quit. We have to continue to step out in faith. We have to continue to obey God even when we can't see how God could possibly make this work. And so I'll ask you again, are you willing to get out of the boat? Are you willing to walk on water? Are you willing to follow our older brother when he calls us to do something? Are you learning that and putting that into practice even now, right here at the feast? I hope so. It's a wonderful opportunity. And we've got all kinds of encouragement here. We're all pulling the same way. You've got a huge family here to support, to encourage. And I hope we will continue to learn, to grow in faith. There's one more question I want to ask. I've asked if you're willing to get out of the boat and walk on water, but maybe there's a question we ought to ask even before that. Are you willing to get into the boat to begin with? Are you even in the boat? You see, you can't get out of it and walk on water if you've never been in the boat to begin with. The boat is the church of God. It's what God has called you and me to, giving us an opportunity to get in and start this journey. If you're not old enough yet to be baptized and formally make that commitment to get in the boat, is that your goal? Do you have a desire when the time is right? When you're old enough, do you have a desire to make that commitment? You see, that's something you can be working toward even now. And when you're old enough, you can talk with your pastor and you can begin to counsel for baptism. You can formally get in the boat. But you'll never be able to step out. You'll never be able to walk on water if you don't get in the boat to begin with. Brethren, life isn't going to be easy, and God's never promised us that it would. But He does promise us that He will never leave us nor abandon us. There are times when we're going to face challenges where we feel like we're dancing over the heads of alligators and crocodiles, where we feel like we've got to get out and walk over the top of water in the middle of a full-blown gale, a dangerous storm. And when that becomes necessary, we have to learn to keep our eyes glued to God. Remember His promises. Remember what He's done for us in the past, that faith that we've built with experience with Him over time. We have to learn to get out and walk on water. And when we do, our God will make sure that we're able to succeed.